Hey, Aaron, I feel like we've been using the old intro a lot. Maybe we should make a new intro.
Yeah. Hey, this is Power in the Wilderness. I'm Aaron Brown in Minnesota.
And I'm Carl Jacob in New York. And this is episode 8. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this is an episodic podcast. So there are 7 episodes before this that explain the story up to this point. If you're listening on the radio, you're welcome to listen to this episode, but no, you should go to powerinthewilderness.com to catch up with where we're at. We only got 2 more episodes to go after this, Aaron.
We're going to have to wrap this up, I think. I
feel like we've moved past peak Vic, and now we're into the beginning of tired Vic.
The grinding of the gears.
The gears of war, to be specific.
That's right.
Because 1917, which is when this episode starts, is the year that America chooses to engage in the Great War, also known as World War I.
They didn't know about 2 back then, so it was just the Great War.
Right.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away.
So as we had previously mentioned, World War I was felt in Hibbing a little bit before it was felt in the rest of the country because of the fact that U.S. Steel was providing steel for the other members of what will become the Allied forces. Hell, they were probably providing steel to both sides. I don't really know.
There were products that ended up in the German forces. Various companies used steel from U.S. Steel and other independent miners. So yeah, it was kind of a two sides thing, mostly to the Allies just because of the natural trade relationship with Great Britain.
But now it's real. Now the U.S. is fully into the war.
We're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there, over there, over there. Spread the word, over there. That's the end.
Everything in Hibbing changes. There are the ethnic lines that were starting to get drawn a little bit when the war started, when the Germans and Austrians were drilling in the streets, take new shape now that the U.S. is actually in the war. And 2 things happened to the people who came from countries that were on the other side. They either went back to their countries to fight, or they had to really go above and beyond to prove that they were real Americans through service, through purchasing war bonds, through giving donations, and through volunteering. It was a real test to see how patriotic they could be. And this is the first time in America's history where the entire country was really charged up by the government to be patriotic. So the folks who did not step up were shamed. And the ones who refused to step up, a lot of them left. They went back home.
If you were drafted and you didn't show up for service, or if you didn't register for the draft, they printed your name in the paper. It was well known. And conversely, if you donated to the cause, to the Red Cross, if you bought war bonds, if you, of course, enlisted, your name was put in the paper in a very nice article. It talked about the great American, great people from Hibbing who were serving. Even non-citizens could serve. And so it was very clear, you know, there was a reward for doing the right thing and being a good American, and also a social punishment for those who did not participate. And a lot of these miners, their families especially, you know, keep in mind the new generations coming up. There's young teenagers who are coming of age who maybe were born overseas but grew up here in Hibbing. And they're on notice. Which side are you going to be on? And of course, everybody's just signing up. They're playing the songs in the street. Flags are flying everywhere. It's patriotic fervor.
The seniors in the high school disappear.
Yeah.
It was a ghost class. Like there were 2 people enrolled,
yeah,
at the junior college.
The Hibbing Junior College had 2 people enrolled in classes the year after the war started, and they were both young women. All of the eligible men were either serving in the military or working in the mine, which was considered an equal patriotic duty. You could get out of service if you were working in the mine, but if you were working in the mine, a portion of your wages were expected to be given to the war effort. They would literally go through the mines telling you, you best give your $2 for the week or whatever it was. And again, if you didn't, you were shamed.
Though you're leaving me today, never fear. In my thoughts you'll always be ever near. There's a tear in every eye as the boys go marching by, but they're out the door, I hear them clear. All the things you plan to do, I am sure they will come true, and I'll watch and wait for you over here. Au revoir, but not goodbye, soldier boy. Brush that teardrop from your eyes, soldier boy. When you're on the deep blue sea, will you sometimes think of me? I'll be waiting anxiously, soldier boy.
And when we last left Vic, he was just coming off of the graft trials. He was basically under attack from the state government because Governor Burnquist didn't want him to run for governor. At this point, he was kind of licking his wounds a little bit, even though he had succeeded at beating back the gubernatorial smashing or attempted smashing. He's spending less time publicly speaking. He's spending more time publicly drinking. And I would imagine he's ready for a break. He was tired.
Yeah.
And now this, the war that is putting him in a really precarious position, because Vic is not a guy who easily chooses sides unless he's fighting the Oliver or U.S. Steel. And now there's a population that's even more divided, and there's pressure from the federal and state government for Vic to choose sides. And he really has no choice but to go patriotic, or as Aaron would put it,
he has to go Captain America. And you can just imagine him sliding on the red, white, and blue suit of Captain America, perhaps a little more snug on him than on others. But he definitely changes his rhetoric to be more about America, less about the evils of the mining company, which he leaves alone. It's not like he spares them. Or I should say, it's not like he loves up to the mining companies so much as he stops complaining about them and starts complaining about Germans and foreign powers that seek to destroy us and how we all need to pull together as Americans to win this war.
I mean, he was really good at unifying people. So
right.
When Vic does go Captain America, it probably is the best political decision in terms of preventing unrest in the city.
And I think, too, Vic is proud to be an American. He's a first generation. His father was an immigrant. His father fought in the Civil War. And both he and his brother Walter, Victor and his brother Walter, really idolized their father's war service. It really was a source of pride for them. And I think both of them, now slightly older, they're not going to be soldiers, but see it as their chance to, you know, be home leaders for the war effort.
I thought it was humorous that Vic went and signed up for the draft.
Yeah.
He made a big photo op of it. He invited the newspapers down to take pictures because clearly Vic was not going to get drafted. He probably couldn't even pass the basic fitness tests to get in to the military. But nonetheless, he had to show his patriotism and be a good role model for the citizens of Hibbing, which, by the way, had one of the highest enlistment rates for young men in the entire country, which was pretty remarkable.
Right. In addition to the draft, actually more people enlisted than were drafted, which was unusual. And it was an enormous number of people. And each time, Victor Power was insistent on this, every time a group of young men left to go to war, they did a big event. There, the band was there. They had a little mini parade. They had a big send-off at the depot as the young men got on the train. And they did it almost every week for every batch of soldiers. So it was a full-time job for a lot of these people, including Vic, to just keep that enthusiasm up, to keep the spirits up.
So the implications of this, practically speaking, for Vic's previous pre-war agenda of civic improvements is kind of overshadowed by the war right now. So the improvements don't necessarily come to a screeching halt, but they're not as exalted as they were previously. and they're not really getting the same amount of resources as they were previously. So they kind of slow down a little bit. The other practical issue that Vic is facing right now is he was very deft at straddling this line of republicanism, but also listening to the workers and what the workers' needs were. One could call it socialist. I've called it socialist, but he wasn't necessarily a socialist either. The point is that he was very good at taking the ideologies of the working class needing to better themselves and could fold it into the ideologies of the progressive Republican movement at this time. But now America is involved in this world war where Russia has become a loose cannon and sort of devolved into what one might call chaos after the Russian Revolution, which was fueled by communism. And communism becomes a dirty word in America at large and in Hibbing. And U.S. Steel grabs onto this and uses it as fuel to knock down any budding attempts of what they call communism, which might just be organizing workers in a way that they were incapable of doing before the war. So this is a tricky situation for Vic, because this is kind of knocking also with that him down off of his high horse a little bit. And all this right after the Graft trials, you know, it was like, it's just a continuation of the pummeling that Vic got when he first came into office, where it's just these punches that are now just coming at him in rapid succession. And he doesn't have the same amount of energy as he did a couple of years ago.
It reminds me of one of those war pictures where these, you know, soldiers fight to win over a hill at great cost and great energy, and then you get to the top of the hill and you look down and realize there's a whole other army and a whole other hill on the other side. It's been like this for Vic for a while. I often refer to, you know, the tax fight and the battle with William West and even the strike and all of this as almost, and then the Graft trials, they're like a siege on Victor Power's Hibbing. Well, what if the end of the siege was an actual war with actual sieges on the other side of the earth that you now have to manage? And just you mentioned the balance that Vic had to make here. You know, keep in mind, in 1915, Vic is talking about state ownership of the iron mines. I mean, he's casually dropping hints that, you know, the state should own this, not the Oliver. Then 2 years later, we're in World War I, and socialism is a dirty word. And now he, you know, whatever I said back there, that was just some crazy talk. I really was talking just about making it better for the workers and giving them a fair shake. You know, I wasn't really talking about state ownership of mines. Come on, man. And so it really does change what he can talk about. Because when he said that in 1915, it wasn't as radical as it might sound today. It was something that other countries were doing, and it was, socialism was, you know, like a flavor of tea you could drink. There's different flavors, not everybody's flavor, but come World War I and after the Russian Revolution, when it was realized that whole systems of government could be overthrown by people. To really understand what this Russian Revolution was in its context of its time, you have to imagine that one day you're watching the news and you see the president on TV and you're like, that's the president. Then there's like a Speaker of the House and it's all fancy and stuff. But then the next day you turn on the television and a guy from the gas station who's wearing the uniform of his gas station is the president now. And he's surrounded by other gas station workers and hotel clerks and maids and Uber drivers. And they're behind him like in a phalanx and he's in charge now. That's scary for a lot of people.
Yeah, especially for a newly formed United States government that's just starting to get their bearings as becoming a world superpower. So I guess your point, Aaron, is that you can't really blame the government too much after seeing what happened in wanting to try to prevent that from happening in this country. But that's not to say that's what was actually going on. That's the part that's so much of a bummer in this situation. There was good momentum for the betterment of people's lives that was truly getting not quite reversed yet, but halted, slowed down at the very least.
Well, Russia was a cautionary tale because the people rising up for their betterment was not in doubt, but the chaos that followed led to a power vacuum that was filled by Lenin and eventually Stalin,
right,
and authoritarian rule.
Which is what tends to happen.
And this is what was feared in the United States.
And the other part of this puzzle is that if we remember what happened after the strike, the wages went up for all of the workers. So the workers that were upset about their low wages don't have the same complaints that they had a year ago because they have higher wages now and they're starting to get more comfortable because they can pay their bills. So it's not as easy to get the working class base riled up.
They're not united.
They're not united anymore, and the war effort is definitely cooling those fires even more. So Vic's Captain America, you know, in addition to his draft photo op, he's also donating heaps of money to the Red Cross. He's on a committee that oversees coal distribution to make sure the coal's not being wasted. And then there's the Home Guards, which is kind of an extension of, in a way, these send-offs that they're giving to all the young boys who are going off to war. But it's the older dudes who can't go off to war who feel like they need something to do, but you can explain it a little better, Aaron.
S. Valentine Saxby is one of the people who coordinates this. He's the Vic's personal secretary, and he's got family fighting in the war in Europe and has this whole time. So he's very enthusiastic. The Home Guards are mostly older guys, not real old, but the kind of guys just a little past when you could probably join the military. A lot of immigrants who have been there a long time are in the Home Guards, among them Vic's friend Delmo Befra, the Italian community leader and mechanic and motorcycle racer. He's in the Home Guards along with a number of others, and they're the ones who are standing in formation when the soldiers leave and all the different ceremonies that are being held. They hold little drills and things, and the idea is that they're there in case there's trouble if the Germans break through and somehow land on the American coast and somehow penetrate the inner continent and come to Hibbing. They'll be the ones defending City Hall from the Germans. That's the premise anyway, but they're mostly ceremonial.
That's not unlike some of the thinking that has been going on lately with the perceived invasion of people from Mexico and
oh, sure, yeah.
The difference is that we're not in a war with Mexico right now.
You know, this is a world where there's cartoons every day in the paper showing German atrocities, you know, of horrible German things, and the Hun is out to get you, and it's in the propaganda being spread everywhere, so people are genuinely afraid even if the risk of the war coming to Hibbing is very low.
So 1917 Hibbing looks very different than 1916 Hibbing. The only thing that's the same is the idea that working in the mines was somehow helping the World War effort, even more so now. And Vic going Captain America is also very alienating for him. And it's alienating for the relationships that he has with the trade unions. Because the trade unions now are seeing him as separating himself from this idea of the power of labor, and they're also coming into their own as organizations. So they start to change their tone on Vic, and a wedge is starting to be driven in between Vic and the trade unions.
The trade unions have two sides as well. They have a radical side, people pushing them to be more proactive in going after capital, and then a more conservative side that's like, let's get what we can, but let's stick with America. And Samuel Gompers, the leader of the AFL, is on this side. And it's Vic's on the more conservative side of that equation, which proves to be a difficult place to be because the other side's gaining power.
The other side being?
Being the more radical, aggressive side.
Is that the Nonpartisan League?
It becomes the origins of the Nonpartisan League, yeah.
And the Nonpartisan League eventually, spoiler alert, merges with the Democratic Party at the time and becomes the DFL, which is the Democratic Farmer Labor Party that we have to this day in Minnesota.
Right.
Now, this nonpartisan organization, in a last ditch effort to try to include Vic in their cause at this time, asks him to run for attorney general on their behalf, but he declines.
Yeah.
because he feels that it is not in alignment with his new Captain America logo.
And also he would have, I think, liked to run for governor. And
well,
and
yes.
And they had given that spot to somebody else. Actually, Charles Lindbergh's father, Charles Sr., was the candidate that year for governor. And Vic was supposed to be running as the attorney general. Well, Vic declined. And also because the Nonpartisan League, despite its rather tame-sounding name, was considered at the time a very radical organization. And during this anti-socialist, anti-radical attitude of the war, it was seen as a dangerous organization, the America's version of the Bolsheviks, which was a very scary word. So it was, Vic calculated, probably correctly, that running that year with the Nonpartisan League would have pinned him in on his political coalition.
They come from every quarter, from the north, south, east, and west, to clear the way to freedom for the land we love the best. We've left our occupation and home so far and dear, but when the going's rather rough, raise a song of cheer. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as mine. Good
now morning. Let's go back to Governor Bernquist, the fella who attacked Vic with the graft trials.
Right.
If you can imagine how Captain America Vic is, just think how Captain America Governor Bernquist is, because this is totally already in alignment with his ideology at this time. And he takes it even one step further, and he forms this organization called the Minnesota Public Safety Commission, which, for lack of a better term, is very similar to the Gestapo, in that it's a militarized police investigation force whose job it is to roam the state, beating and arresting people who are not publicly backing the war effort. And I can only imagine that Vic is thinking about the fact that Governor Bernquist has a roaming gang of dudes just ready to beat anyone that he claims is not in alignment with the war effort. So
in Minnesota at this time, there are towns that were founded by Germans and that still have German language newspapers with German-speaking mayors. And in these towns, the Public Safety Commission basically runs the elected council out of office and imprisons them for violations of federal law. And it's one of the more aggressive in the whole country for state anti-radicalism. Vic knows this. He's already tangled with Bernquist, and he came out on top, but it was a tough fight. He didn't come out perfect in the end. And he doesn't want any more of that at this point.
And while all of this is happening, the Oliver sees an opportunity to make a chess move that's been on their minds and waiting in the wings, and now they can act on. And all they need to do now is leverage the fact that this great need for wartime steel is pushing them to make these hard decisions. What is the hard decision? Well, in 1917, in August, the Tribune announces that there is a, quote, rumor circulating that the Oliver is interested in buying out properties in the main business district of Hibbing.
Although not confirmed at the local office of the Oliver Iron Mining Company, it is learned this morning that 40 acres of land owned by N.P. Larrabee in Alice has been purchased by the Oliver Company, and residences and shops at the Penobscot location will be moved there. The move is taken to indicate that the ore company plans on extensive mining operations this year and next to increase the ore output and provide the needs of the government. The Larrabee 40 has already been cleared. This work started in April. It is also claimed in responsible circles this morning that the Oliver Company has taken options on several business properties between North Street and the Mesabi Park. And I could go on, but this is all of the north 40 acres of the village of Hibbing. Hibbing at this time has three sections, the north 40 original town site, Pillsbury, and southern. The top third of the village, it is being rumored here, is being bought out by the mines so they can mine right underneath it. That's an enormous news story.
In this article from the Mesabi Ore the following month, There are approximately 27 million tons of iron ore underlying the village of Hibbing. This ore is owned by the Steel Corporation, which is buying up all of the surface rights above the ore contained on a 40-acre tract, which at present embraces the main business section of the village, and the corporation is paying most liberally for what it wants. On the other hand, the Steel Corporation or any of the other mining concerns operating in the district is not in any way interfering or trying to interfere with the local government. In fact, the corporation seems inclined to lead the way to a better order of things, thanks to the effort now being put forth by Mike Godfrey, the corporation's new representative in the Hibbing District. Okay, so we just heard about Mike Godfrey. We'll get to him in a second. But before we do that, I want to clarify what they are saying when they're using the word move in this context. Mm-hmm. Because when we think of move now, when we're saying, oh, we're moving to a new location, you think you're taking your desks and your chairs and you're moving to a new building and putting your stuff in that new building. Well, at this time in Hibbing's history, there were no new buildings in South Hibbing, also known as Alice. So what did they do? They didn't take the desks and chairs out of the building. They took the entire building and jacked it up and put it on a train car and rolled it south.
Yeah, they're not fooling around here. And every building has to go. So this is it would be unusual, but not perhaps that remarkable if one building was being moved in this fashion. But a whole 40-acre tract of a very dense village was being moved in this way. The place where they're moving the stuff to is half swamp, half pile of mine waste. And they're filling it in with dirt. They're spreading out the mine dump. They're digging up and making a place for a new village, essentially, near what was once called Alice. But actually just east of there is the location where they're moving the new business district. And the Oliver has done something pretty amazing here. They took the story, which is the mines are going to buy out North Hibbing and get as many people as possible to move to a new location. But they've made it kind of almost subtle in that people are like, ooh, everybody's moving, huh? You know, the two stories we just read are kind of approaching the story from the back a little bit, like very gingerly touching it ever so slightly because of the perilous political situation with the war. So the whole town is on top of this, and the mine is going to entice the town to move with new improvements that they're willing suddenly to pay for to get the town to move.
And we're jumping ahead a little bit in the story, but I just want to put a little bow on this to talk about the move, because the move is a very popular story in Hibbing's history. And if you grew up in Hibbing, you hear all about the town that moved. There's even a musical that someone wrote about it once that was performed at the new high school.
Growing Pains, it's called.
Growing Pains, yeah.
It's not good, but it was a musical.
And if you go to our website and to the Hibbing Historical Society's website, it is littered with all of these photos of these houses being rolled on these train cars and in a couple of cases rolled on logs, which was what the poorer people had to do who couldn't afford to hire the train cars. And when I say train cars, it's not like something with an engine. We're talking about a little flatbed with four wheels on it that you gotta pull along with horses.
Or a traction engine. They used a lot of those. They're like little tractors, yeah.
There are some stories we've read of people who were kids at the time who got to ride in their house as they were moving south. And they describe sitting in their bed and looking out the window, watching the world go by as their house is getting moved south. But at this point in our story, it's not quite that crazy yet. It's just starting to get like that. And these deals are being done under the table very quietly. And if someone raises a fuss about it, the war effort and the need for steel is used as an excuse. But U.S. Steel wants to, like you said, Aaron, keep this on the down low. So even though Vic knows that this is kind of going on, he hasn't fully caught on to the extent of what's happening quite yet because he's been so distracted by the war effort. And he's also distracted by the fact that he really has a desire to try to run for governor in 1918. And this is all happening at the same time. You're listening to Power in the Wilderness on KAXE KBXE Northern Community Radio. This brings us into 1918, and Vic attempts to go and file for the governorship, which he wasn't able to do when he was fighting the Burnquist charges. He wants to make a big PR splash, and he gets on the train to go down to file. And on his way, he's somehow intercepted, and he's convinced that he would not win if he attempted to run for governor in 1918.
Among the parties that may have approached him, most likely were organized labor, who said that the climate was so unfavorable right then for their cause that they didn't want to waste Power's candidacy on a losing campaign. And Burnquist would run on the slogan, "He kept Minnesota loyal," which gives you a real sense of the flavor of the kind of candidate he was. Vic was convinced, though. He decided they were right. And whether they had something on him or whether it was more like, just don't do it, Vic, you're going to blow your political career trying this. Whatever it was, he went down there to file but came back empty-handed, saying, "I've decided for the good of the war effort not to run."
And part of that decision-making is likely, too, that Burnquist isn't going to stay in office forever. And if he can run on a Republican ticket 2 years later in 1920 and not have to fight Burnquist, his odds are probably going to be a lot better if he does that.
It's still a Republican state, and coming out of the war, the Republicans are the overwhelmingly dominant party. Vic wants to run and win as a Republican if he can.
And lo and behold, shortly after Vic decides to not run for governor, as is his increasing luck these days, armistice happens with World War I.
Submarine and oil, they've been bright and true. God bless them. Now the war is over, over there. We'll have to take our hats right off the deck.
Though the army is the clover, 'twas the navy took them over,
and the navy will bring them back.
Just a few days after Burnquist wins re-election as governor of Minnesota, peace is declared. The Allies have won the war.
And that's probably something that would ultimately hurt Burnquist down the road, I imagine, because he doesn't really have anything to rile up his base anymore. So it's likely that Burnquist is not going to run in 1920. So we're kind of skipping over 1918 a little bit. This was also the year that the Spanish flu started appearing in the United States. And Hibben got hit really hard. And there's a really great character that we don't get to spend too much time with on this podcast, but we did sort of an offshoot podcast about her. Her name was Hattie Mosley, who was brought into town by Dr. Wyrick at the Rood Hospital to care for the people of Hibbing during this time. And she was this really badass nurse who was responsible for saving a lot of people's lives and caring for a lot of people and going to the homes of families whose moms or dads were in the hospital and like cooking meals for families. And she was one of the very few black people in Hibbing at this time, which was really an outlier because there wasn't a huge black population in Hibbing, if there was one at all. It was just not something that was widely accepted at this point in Hibbing's history. And in 1918, Hibbing is more of the same in terms of where they're at politically and with the war and all this stuff. Even after armistice happens, it takes a little while for things to ramp down. It takes a while for the boys to come home. And a lot of them don't come home until 1919. That same year, Vic gives a speech at a Republican conference called, it was the Lincoln Dinner, right?
Yeah, the Lincoln Day Dinner. It's a big Republican event for the state of Minnesota. It's one of the big proving grounds for gubernatorial candidates and statewide candidates.
And Vic is one of the big speakers at this event. He gives a speech outlining all of these temporary changes that the party had to endure during the war and makes a case for how everyone in the Republican Party can move forward together and begin a correction from the damage of what the war has done to the country. It might have been a little too soon for that speech.
He gave for a Republican, a revolutionary speech.
Power began his speech by quoting President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. These words of Lincoln have a particular significance for us at the present time. Governmental authority cannot be exercised successfully unless the consent of the people is first secured. We must have a government of the masses, of the people, and not of any class. We have failed to get close enough to the thoughts of the great classes of our people, the respectable laboring classes. Today, in trying to get rid of those who want to destroy our country, we must take into our consoles the representatives of labor. We must learn the condition of the mind of the people, and where can we learn that better than among the labor classes? We must drive from our midst the proponents of special privilege. Their actions are fraught with peril for the future of our country. This is one of the few things imperiling the country, in addition to the peril of those who want to tear down the government. So long as we keep men assured that there will be no violation of their constitutional rights, they will surely realize that more can be done for progress through peaceable means than through any organization of destruction. Liberty, justice, and freedom are the birthright of every American. We should be careful during the Reconstruction period not to place upon our statute books any laws abridging the rights of free speech or hindering the advancement of mankind through respectable labor organizations. During the war, we did many things as emergency measures which we would not tolerate in times of peace. Lincoln's policies of government made it an absolute necessity for men to organize in order to advance the purpose of government. We must be careful in judging public sentiment, to be sure we learn public sentiment. The press of the nation has largely become an institution made for profit, and often tries to develop public sentiment for the benefit of special privilege. We should wipe from our statute books emergency measures put there during the war. Otherwise, these will be taken as in some degree abridging the limitations of the Constitution. Let us have the government Lincoln advocated, a government by the people, for the people, of the people. Then we need fear no destructive forces in our midst. This is a great speech.
It's a great speech. And by the way, if you missed the subtext there, this is why it's such an important speech in Vic's political career. Right after the war ends, he comes in front of the biggest name Republicans and fundraisers and lobbyists and journalists, and he says, "You know what's just as bad as a bomb-throwing anarchist radical Bolshevik? These assholes who are running the show right now." And while that is politically probably something his supporters wanted to hear back in Hibbing, they loved the speech. It was a big middle finger to the Republican Party that was now running the state. And for an audition for the guy to run that party and the state's Republican operation, it was a heck of a thing to say. And he also takes a swipe at the big newspapers that are sitting in attendance taking down this speech. And as a result, the reaction to the speech outside of Hibbing is muted, maybe even a little hostile, because they view it as somewhat radical, even though Vic says, you know, "Oh, we don't like radicals." But you know who's as bad as radicals? Special privileges, you know, the privileged classes who...
All of the people sitting in this room.
Basically all of the people sitting in this room. Heck of a thing. Shows he had a lot of stones, but he certainly paid a political price, because after this speech, he is no longer mentioned as a leading candidate for governor for the state of Minnesota.
Ugh. It was his death knell.
Yeah, he told too much truth.
So he goes back to Hibbing, maybe not necessarily knowing what he just did with his speech, but he was savvy enough to probably get the idea that his chances of running for governor a third time were totally squashed. I mean, three strikes, you're out, right?
Yeah, well, he never officially did run. He came close to running in 16. He came close to running in 18. And he could run in 20. It's early yet. This is still 1919. But the idea of him as a rising star, a young upstart mayor from a small town who defied the world's largest corporation, that's getting to be old news now in the court of public opinion.
Well, it took 2 years for news to get old back then.
Yeah.
It takes 2 days for news to get old nowadays.
Exactly. Well, and the war cleared the deck. It's a post-war world now. It's the roaring 20s are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And things are just different. And Hibbing is moving. So he comes back to Hibbing. His town's moving. His business interests are involved. So he starts to pay attention to them as well, his law practice and his real estate. And as a result, Vic kind of loses the thread on the statewide story of Vic Power, the upstart. The tone changes just a bit. And you can see it and feel it in how Vic even governs in Hibbing. He's still saying some of the same things. He's fighting the mines on things like taxes. But he calms down. He chills out just a little. And he's also dealing with a much more complex village and the biggest project the village would ever face, which is relocating itself to a new location.
Let's get back to Michael Godfrey,
yeah,
who we mentioned a little while ago in this episode. So back when Vic won the major tax battle with U.S. Steel and had that famous closed-door meeting with William West, who was the former superintendent of the Oliver Mining Company back then, who, by the way, after that closed-door meeting was over, was removed from power by U.S. Steel and relocated to somewhere outside of Hibbing.
Yeah, he was given a less choice location. He was demoted, essentially, out of the Hibbing spot because of the way that turned out.
Which, I know it's hard to feel sorry for that guy, but, you know, he didn't really have a choice in that matter.
Mm-hmm.
He was forced to the table. His allegiance to U.S. Steel should have been rewarded, in my opinion, but you know what? This is, I guess, how they dealt with these things. Not even their high-ranking employees were safe from persecution. Anyway, Michael Godfrey is now in charge. And we were recently able to talk, surprisingly, to a living family member of Michael Godfrey.
Hello?
Hi, Dan?
Yes.
Dan, Aaron? This is Aaron Brown calling.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm going to merge in Carl.
Dan wrote a book that came out a few years back.
In just a second here.
Can you hear me, Dan?
Is that Carl?
Yeah. And is one of the rare people who has, like us, been through most of the newspapers of this era.
Just tell us about your book and what you've researched about Old North Hibbing.
Well, on my book, I had heard, of course, from my family, my mother, her aunts, her brothers, her sisters, about their father.
You're related to Mike Godfrey.
My mother was one of his daughters.
Can you briefly tell us about Godfrey?
He was a big official of the Oliver. He was a very nice man, and he liked to read the funny papers on Sunday dressed in his best suit.
Michael Godfrey had worked at the Oliver for a while now under West, and had made a name for himself there and was in a unique position of power by this time. If William West was a classic sort of villain who used the stick, Godfrey was the keep your enemies closer kind of guy who is more interested in using carrots. And he and Vic had known each other for a while. Vic was also very close with his brother, TJ. They would go hunting together. They would go on trips together. So it was a different kind of person representing the Oliver. And the Oliver trusted Godfrey in a way that I think they didn't trust West for some reason. Godfrey was able to sort of sit on this line between Victor Power and the Oliver in a way that felt friendly to both. It was quite a feat, if you ask me. And the relationship that develops between Vic and Godfrey is a good one. Michael Godfrey was regularly seen visiting Vic's office for meetings, checking in on Vic, seeing how he was doing, ask him what he needed. And their relationship becomes very warm.
Compared to the relationship he had with William West, Godfrey and Vic have a, you know, bosom buddyhood.
Godfrey needed a lot of leverage. You know, he was the big bad employer, and whenever there was a strike, guess who got blamed?
What would you say was Mike Godfrey's contribution to Hibbing?
He was the man who consolidated all 56 above ground and underground mines into one giant consortium. Secondly, and I think more importantly, although he doesn't get any credit, he moved North Hibbing. He conceived of the idea and had no opposition from Vic Power. Why not?
The town has clearly come to the point where Hibbing, what we now refer to as North Hibbing, has to really move. And the mine succeeded in getting that ball rolling during the war. And the buildings around Vic and his family members, his brother's office building, Vic's office building, Dottie's department store, they got to go. And Vic, I don't know if he was holding out or what the thinking was, but he wasn't the first one to sell out of the North 40. And by 1920, he has a realization that it's probably time for him to seriously consider moving his operations south before it's too late.
Godfrey had an acetate covering over the Central and Park Addition.
He's talking about a map here with a plastic covering over it of all the plots that the Oliver owns in the new South Hibbing.
And he invited all the businessmen and all the residents in the Southern Pillsbury and original Platts to come in and put down their preference on that acetate covering where they wanted their business or their residence to go. And he gave all that to Power, who then, of course, being a politician, said he had to present it to the village council. Power went on record as saying that he would be the guardian of the people.
There was some kind of deal that was struck in that room that day where Vic and Walter and Dottie would sell out their properties and buy properties in South Hibbing and reestablish the Power family's center of power in the new downtown Hibbing.
I don't think those two were adversaries, really. I think they were sort of on opposite sides of the fence, but they understood each other. He and Power, I think, engineered the move. I think Mike laid it out, and Power simply agreed with him and helped them out. And Vic certainly didn't suffer as a result.
The Powers got the very best spots in the new Howard Street Business District. They're still the best spots if you go to Hibbing today. And they got this, and part of the reason they got such a good location for their spots was because of the symbolic value of what Godfrey and the Oliver was getting from them. They were symbolically moving from north to south, demonstrating to the town that this move was inevitable and that fighting it would be just dumb. It's not going to work. The biggest fighter you got is Vic Power, and he made the decision to move. You all better move too. The symbolic value of this was enormous.
Can you imagine his followers who were backing him for the last 7 years with all of the fights that he had against the Oliver, and he pulls something like this? And I don't know if necessarily that he's pulling anything, but the perception that he has pulled one over on the people, I'm sure was felt hard by some people. And it's clear in reading the newspapers of the time that it was felt hard. There were people who felt like they were duped, that Vic Power had betrayed them by taking this deal. But I can see both sides of the story. I mean, Vic knew several years before this that moving was an inevitability. He showed his cards on that when he was going into the tax deal negotiations.
Yeah.
So the fact that he finally pulled the trigger, just in hindsight, when we look at it now, makes complete sense. But, you know, we don't have to go into it too deeply, but there was definitely a major outcry that happened, especially when after Vic moved, the property values of that North 40 went way down, and anyone that moved after Vic did not get the same deal that Vic did and everyone before him. That's what tipped the scales to really pissing off some of the merchants that used to be on his side. In fact, isn't it this time when his longtime buddy and person who really helped him rise to power, W.J. Ryder, turned on him?
Yeah, William J. Ryder finds himself in a class of merchants that start suing the village and the Oliver Iron Mining Company on their own because they felt duped by this deal. And so it's a symbolic breaking of the original Power Coalition. Ryder and a few others Not the majority. Most of the people stick with Vic because they got a good deal too going to the South Hibbing. There's a lot more room. It's going to be a model village. They're trying to build something really nice there. And that's what a lot of people see. But a lot of people who were left with longtime real estate in North Hibbing or those in the Pillsbury or Southern additions that weren't being moved felt like they were getting stuck with a bad situation. And it divides the town. It's very clear for the next several years the town is fighting itself.
And it's also at this time that ground is broken for what will become the new Hibbing High School in South Hibbing.
And it's important to remember that this high school was probably part of the deal.
Power in the Wilderness is produced by Aaron Brown and Carl Jacob and edited by me, Carl Jacob.
The show is made possible in part by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
If you'd like to hear past episodes of Power in the Wilderness,
or if you'd like to see pictures about the people and places we talk about, you're going to want to check out our website, powerinthewilderness.com. It's really cool.
We'll see you next time on Power in the Wilderness.
Get out of here. took you in. Now all you got to offer me is a drink of gin. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too.
Thank you.